I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Downstairs, we were just talking about the structure of this as a collection. And for those of you who have not yet read this collection, at least in the UK edition, it's in four discrete kind of units or spaces. And I just wondered whether you'd like to say a little about that, how you've demarcated those stories, and whether, when you were writing them, that chronology followed, or whether it was a case of shuffling them into that order later?
Yeah, it was definitely later. I had a bag of stories, and I think I desperately wanted to feel I could do something to make them better, some kind of collective magic that if I put them in the right order, that they would be better than they were alone. I think organizing a story collection seems foolish in some sense, because when I read one myself, I might start with the middle story, I read the last story. There was, for a little while, a kind of urban legend that in story collections, by far the best story is always the second one. Has anyone ever heard that? And so I'll very quickly look at the second one.
Me too.
I think it's been proven.
No comment.
So, in part, I'm aware that what I'm doing by putting these in an order is something that won't necessarily add up to anything for anyone else. But when I read them all, I thought, well, they have these different emotional impacts. Some are grave and bleak, and some are graver and bleaker. Some have a first-person male narrator. Others have a protagonist as a woman, and it's a third-person close. And so I think I just fooled around with trying to build up a little bit of variety and also wondering a little bit what the stories are about. And some days I thought they were literally all the same and all about the same thing, so moving them around didn't do much. But there were ones I wanted to keep apart from each other. They seemed hostile right up against each other. The Grow Light Blues and the Trees of Sawtooth Park could sometimes feel sort of interchangeable to me, and so I wanted to keep them apart so people might not see that. So it's a lot of just kind of covering weaknesses and... There's a section three. It's just more abstract and it's less narrative a little bit. And wherever I go, people will say to me, you know, no one wants to read that shit. You have to hide it in your book. And so that's why in some editions, there's a section 3.1 that has some really, really abstract stuff. I'm kidding. Those were just things that didn't make it into the book. So I guess it's a... Maybe it's just an attempt at curation, like as you would with a mixtape. Although mixtape, maybe can one even say that anymore?
Yeah, does anyone here
maybe
know
people
what a
don't even know
is?
What a mixtape is. I think I don't know what it is anymore. Putting some songs together for someone you're desperately in love with who pays no attention to you.
Right.
Thinking if they listen to your choices of songs, they will suddenly feel this incredible erotic connection, but also real warmth and curiosity, and that your life will be changed simply because you put some songs in a certain order. So that's my hope. with these stories. And the book is new. I've yet to hear if it's working.
I was going to say, thanks for coming to this Apple event of the Shuffle that we're in direct competition with, and competition, don't know what happened.
Ellie told me there's an Apple event right now, so I just want to thank you all. And I've been waiting to go head-to-head with Apple. I kind of feel like it's really, that's the giant to slay right now in literature.
I think, in my mind, it's you and Apple, and in so many different ways. It's
some people say terrifying. Apple, Samsung.
I don't. Marcus versus Apple. Oh,
thank you.
It did make me wonder throughout, knowing that Apple event was going today, which is obviously the center of my world, so much about this is about technology, whether recognizable or in some way teeteringly, terrifyingly prescient. For example, for those of you that have not yet read the book, there are mind-altering gases that are kind of like pheromones almost spurted out into the atmosphere at memorials. There are a number of characters here who are either the agents of or are afflicted by kind of guinea pig processes by shady scientific forces. I just wondered how far you think of yourself as having to kind of preempt turns of technological advancement or encroachment upon society, or whether you're just riffing on what you're seeing, or it's just hideous nightmares of yours writ large.
It's a good question. So the gases, spurting into the atmosphere, it's a story called Blueprints of St. Louis, and there's a married couple, both are architects, and they've sort of newly become involved in memorial design in an America where terrorism is just more common, and one has to kind of erect memorials a few times a year. I'd spent a bit of time in Berlin, and it's an interesting city for a lot of reasons, but there's also a very kind of conscious and overt attempt to memorialize the Holocaust and different strategies for doing that. And I was writing about this couple that was kind of trying to figure out what they wanted these memorials to achieve. They all tend to be solemn and heavy and kind of grave. And I guess I was just thinking, if I were an architect, you create a space and you want people to feel things in the same way as writers. We create a book, you want people to feel things. And why not sort of have more tools to accomplish that? And if you could mist some kind of chemical into the atmosphere, it would just be a kind of natural architectural feature that would maybe ensure that mental state would come about. You wouldn't have to rely on all the variables of an undrugged person walking into a space. And, I would like, if I could have some kind of drug component in my book, just to assist those parts where you're supposed to feel a little more empathy for the character, I would do it. Right. I just think, well, in one way or another, we're trying to do it with language. Why not just... So in other words, it was just a technology that felt at the moment of composition to be a little bit organic and not a pie-in-the-sky invention about, oh, wouldn't it be weird if this weird thing existed? It was meant to not be weird at all, but almost like possibly just the thing that's coming. But again, hopefully it's tucked into the story and not spotlit, because I don't really care about it so much as an invention, as much as like the way then the architects feel, because so pharmaceutical companies are sponsoring these chemicals, and therefore they have a little bit of agency. They become stakeholders in the memorials, right? Because they're paying for this. And so then suddenly the architects feel compromised by working with the pharmaceutical companies. It was really about the sort of personal struggle of dealing with this. And so as much as there's new technology, there's also the absence of it. There's a story called Omen in which a sort of creepy, deviant character is frequently grateful that his thoughts can't be read, but is quite aware that that's a sort of obvious hurdle in the tech world, just thought detection. I don't know. I mean, there's like rudimentary stabs at it. And so he's sort of realizing he's among the last generations to live whose thoughts won't be known, and trying to figure out how he can take advantage of that. not to issue a spoiler. So I don't know, maybe I've strayed a little bit from the question, but if I'm interested in technology, it's much more to me connected to just the way it might debase us or build up desires we can't manage ourselves. And I guess also I think of everything as technology. The glass is a technology that keeps the water from spilling out. Everything is sort of a tool that we're using in one way or another. And it's all sort of horrible.
It's, in terms of it all being sort of horrible, a lot of the characters in this book, in the stories, they consider the body often as a horrible tool or a tool that commits or is useful for horrible acts. There's a lot of shame running through, certainly the first person narrators. They are aware of how shameful their bodies are to themselves, which seems somehow different for them from them being ashamed. They are often abject with shame, but they don't feel embarrassed by it. There's not a lot of embarrassment in these books, and the intimacy that's there is one of abjection, but it's not one of kind of sensitivity and pulling away from what could be shameful. I wondered if that's connected in some way to the use of tech in this, that we're supposed to make our lives easier rather than feeling that we're meant to debase ourselves.
Are you thinking of a specific story with the body shame? I mean, I know maybe it's all of them, but...
I guess in particular, I was thinking of in George and Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
Where even... George, one of the main characters, the protagonist.
The titular character, George.
Indeed, yes. He gives, if that's not a spoiler, he is holding a little dog at some point. I've just got a little puppy, so this is an important story for me.
It's a story in which George gets a dog.
The end. Massive spoiler.
That's kind of it.
Yeah, that I is mean, it. But there's this moment where he's holding the dog, and I was holding the dog, and I was like, this is glorious. And then what happens? You ruined that moment for me. You've ruined dogs.
I reported what I saw.
but the act of touch there and the act of physical intimacy was one based on kind of abhorrence.
Yeah.
And recognition of that abhorrence.
It's a super gross dog. Or George is super gross. And George.
Both.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Well, George's father died and his therapist tells him to get a dog. Because he sort of says he doesn't feel anything after his father dies, and then he's grieving his lack of grief, which is a thing we get to do now. That's an interesting scene to me because I think I like dogs, in theory. Although in my family, I'm the one who has been against acquiring one because I would be the dog tender. I don't know, is there a better word? I'd be the keeper of the dog. And so I'd just have to factor in the labor part of it while the other people in my family factor in the cuddling and the love and all of that. And so I've held out. I think that George ended up being a character who is quite different from me. And so there was a lot that's uncharted. He's essentially someone who has sex with every kind of person in every kind of way to the point of boredom. I have the boredom part, but not the sex with every kind of person part. And I guess I just was looking for some sort of discomfort out of that. He's trying with this dog, but he finds touch unpleasant as if he's kind of he's exhausted the possibilities of contact and is now no longer getting this connection he wants. He also pays to have someone watch him on the internet. There's this guy, actually his name is Guy Fawkes.
I looked it up to see if it was real.
Guy Fawkes. And you can pay him and he'll watch you through your camera, and he just likes to be watched while he's doing his chores. He likes someone to see him. And I don't know why I'm summarizing that story. The body itself, I guess it just seems like an endlessly complex territory. And when I'm trying to get at some sort of discomfort or unease or even joy, it just seems to really always be there. It just seems like such a rich space to explore. And I suppose I'm really not looking to kind of do a lot of joy building and celebratory stuff, and I'm not trying to make people happy. And so, yeah, it may be that I'm focusing on the sort of ways it can fail us and disappoint us a little bit.
Because there's also, as much as there is focus on the disappointment of the body, there's also salves and ointments and lotions being applied to bodies, and the bodies undergoing processes ostensibly to make them stronger or to somehow make them a useful commodity. In fact, one of the stories called Lotion, which I think is one of the shortest ones in the book, doesn't really have a central character. It's the character is this sense of ointment and how that can be part of a healing process, but also part of a pharmaceutical need. I noticed in the pre-title notes that originally was not the title of that work, that it was called Prophecy. And I wondered whether so much of in your novels is about kind of the prophetic and what can be known and explained. Did you feel that story in particular was kind of an allegory for how one should act? That's an easy question.
Yes.
Yeah, an easy answer. Did you feel with that story that you knew exactly how it was going to end?
Well, actually, it was never really a story. There is a kind of art project / kind of, I don't know, a magazine called Thing, based out of California, and they invite writers and artists to make something. They'll make it for you and kind of publish it. And a friend of mine did a pair of sunglasses, and then there was a kind of a companion text, and the sunglasses had some sort of creepy resonance in the text, and I just had always wanted to invent a lotion, and so I made this ointment. I made a cream, and it's called Thompson Cream, and you could buy it
tonight.
Yeah,
what's in that bag?
Yeah. And so then I wrote a text about sort of what the cream was, and the text didn't even have a title, but I think it might have ended up in a different publication later with the title Prophecy, because the cream is actually something that's discovered around areas where something bad has happened. As if there's this kind of forensic investigation and they discover a little bit of cream on a tree. Maybe cream is the wrong word to use in this country, but it's like it's thicker. Well, I guess your cream is quite thick here, actually. I haven't seen it recently, so I don't know what's happening.
Has anyone brought some
what's
cream tonight?
What's the state of British cream? I don't know. I mean, maybe every day it changes, like it's like the stock market.
The cream of the crop.
Yeah. I guess, you know, there was just something enigmatic about it and unknowable to me, and I suppose that's something that I love to chase after. Something kind of that we invest a lot of desire into, but that is ultimately possibly fraudulent. Because I'm selling this cream and it's in a tin, and there was an actual lotion company, like a sort of a beauty supply company that made it, and I had to come up with the actual ingredients, and it was sort of sad because I knew it was essentially a fraudulent lotion. It was not going to at all do what I said it was going to do, and I thought people would be right to be very upset if I was going to say, you know, if you rub this cream on things or yourself, that certain things might happen. I was promising too much. And then I had to put in things like calendula.
What's that?
Well,
should I not ask that? What's that?
I'm not really going to be prepared to give. Someone here must have heard this word. Yeah, it's in lotions.
Okay.
I don't know. It's like a lotion-like thing. Is it a plant? Maybe it's plant-based? Calendula? It's good, right, if you see it on... It's
very
nice.
For women.
Yeah.
I'm writing it
yeah.
down.
It's not like, you know, biophosphate sugar or whatever. It's, you know, calendula. It just seemed so friendly.
That reminds me of when you say in one of the beginning of one of your stories, where is it? That April is too friendly a word for the month. And that everyone's just choking on this kind of salt fug and sloping along, kind of peeling the month off themselves. And there is this...
Oh, you just improved what I wrote, Ellie. That's like
I'm
so
pretty sure
unfair.
That it's, that's a direct quotation.
You just casually upgraded what I wrote.
I don't know what you...
Where were you when I was writing this?
I was smearing something on my body saying, what is this? It smells nice.
You're like, if only this said...
Yeah, I was probably chasing after a dog trying to ointment it as a verb. God help us. There is a sense that a lot of the... You spoke before about how characters, literally, they are stakeholders in some of these narratives. Just in the same way that you're not necessarily in control of the order in which a reader might approach the stories in the collection, how far do you feel in control of the arc of it as a collection? Like, you mentioned Thompson's, the lab, that is a recurrent lab in different kind of iterations,
yeah,
or different kind of control networks going on there. Would you want a reader to keep tabs on that lab to kind of guess a chronology?
Well, and Thompson, to be honest, goes back to my first book written 71 years ago, The Age of Wire and String, and Thompson is a figure who shows up a little bit often in place of God.
Okay.
And I just, at the time, was very amused by the idea that God would be called Thompson instead of God, and I can't connect to that anymore. But so I think that I like the blandness of it. It seemed like the blandest possible name. It seemed like it wasn't an attempt to exoticize something, but rather the reverse,
okay,
to make it plain and banal. And sometimes what happens is I have a lot of fragments of stories and I can't ignite any of them. And there could be a workplace, and I don't. And sometimes I simply just default to really plain names, and so the workplace is called Thompson Systems or Thompson Labs, and it's a placeholder, so that when I finally return to the story and maybe have lifted it off a little bit and turned it into something, going back and changing the name seems really treacherous and unpleasant to me. In fact, I had two stories in which there was a character named Ida. And I kind of couldn't do it. One was young, one was old, and there was no real way to reconcile them. And I spent a lot of time trying to decide which Ida would have to get a name change. And so one of the Idas has to turn into Helen, and I can't even really read that story anymore. It feels wrong.
Yeah.
And no offense to anyone named Helen, because I think it's like an adequate name. Like, it's not a death sentence.
It's
not the name where you're just like, well, you're fucked. There's nothing that will ever...
Well, nor Troy is says it. Differently.
You will die. That is your future, but...
Yeah, more spoilers.
So, but that's, that wasn't my decision.
No, okay. I wondered whether, in terms of names, there's the story, is it Two Boys?
The Boys.
The Boys, I'm sorry, who are not named. And throughout that one is older, one is younger.
Yeah.
That's how that works. And they often, their faces are kind of obscured because they're wearing these helmets and they're always kind of doffing each other on the head with different things.
Doesn't that sound great? Unnamed boys hitting each other over the
it's
head.
It's a cheery tale of
again, it's a
guileless youth.
It's almost an iconic kind of story.
A man with a dog, two kids hitting each other. But I wondered there whether, again, there's something there about intimacy that almost felt for me like as the reader, an intimate act that you had not given them names, that we weren't able to make a network of associations with little Jimmy and little Timmy. Like, they had become iconic in their kind of anonymity.
Well, the story begins with a woman who's announced her sister has died, and her sister has, a husband and these two little boys, and she goes out there to kind of help the family out and announces that she herself has daughters and could never really relate to boys, sort of sees them as, for some reason, aggressive and unpleasant. To me, the story was in part kind of tracking this way that she can kind of come to really love them, but at first she sees them almost interchangeably and a little bit anonymously. And so they just, as I was writing that, they just didn't have names, and the younger one would sound younger and the older one would sound a little older. And when it came time to think about giving them names, it just felt really unnatural. Like I couldn't kind of go back in there and do that without the whole thing falling apart. I'm sure I probably could have, but that's narrated by, so it's in first person, that story. And I suppose it just came out that way that, I don't know, the character names too seem so odd to me because the husband is named Drew. And again, you know, it's sort of like slightly below average name. Maybe not always short for Andrew, it turns out. Sometimes just standalone Drew, which I think those are two really different things. But I think I just didn't want to use that word. Character names have always made me very uneasy. They just seem, you know, fiction, it's so faked, it's so artificial, it's rigged, it's constructed, and I think sometimes when I read it, I'm overwhelmed by the constructedness of it, and then making up names seems very egregious and kind of unpleasant sometimes, and so I try to just kind of quickly get it out of the way and not return to it if I can help it.
But I think that's how the characters also consider their names. So in that story where, which I should remember the name of it, because as with all of them, The Grey Light Blues.
Oh yeah.
Carl, the main character in that.
Yeah.
Again, for those of you that haven't read it, this could be described as a wonderful spin on a man in the first instance sending a dick pic to his work. In many ways, it's nothing to do with that, because no one recognizes what it is a picture of, and instead everyone just reacts.
The terrible
in kind
fate
of
when you take
gentle
that
sorrow, loop. Like what was that?
They think it's part of his neck.
Yeah. And throughout, you don't get the sense that that's his boldest move throughout that story.
Yeah.
And it's completely overlooked. And in that, the name of his boss is the one that is almost passed around the employees.
Oh, Kipler.
Right.
Yeah.
It almost has a Doppler effect to it around the workplace. And so often in your stories, the idea of kind of having a word or a name for something is to know something or to feel like you're able, no, I've attached it to myself. I'm able to respond to that personally, therefore credibly. And it's when words are not possible, where often in your stories it's birdsong, and people are trying to work out how do they interpret the sound of a wordless cry, or it's static, or it's white noise. And it's very telling how some of the characters are at peace there, where they don't know what's being said, while others, it's really a moment where they're thrown into complete disarray because no longer do they have names for anything. They're no longer able to specify what they're encountering. So I guess I'm wondering whether, do you find that having to have, for example, specific locations for your work, as with Blueprint for St. Louis, do you specify for need of people to be able to read it and recognize the place? Or is it because you know that there are certain associations with that place culturally? Mm. Or for you, is there an element of, not autobiography there, but kind of self-recognition of your responsibilities or relationships with place as well as with names?
It's a really good question. When I think about kind of when I was first really seriously reading fiction, I would often be kind of feel bored and detached around descriptions of place and feel that sometimes we're kind of made to suffer through really extended bouts of setting in a story that aren't tethered to really anything dramatic. You know, character's driving along and looks out the window, and then we're gonna have to get some obligatory shit about the mountains and the sky. That it's almost just this habit of fiction with very little regard to, let's say, it's kind of just the dramatic weight of it. And you can go through lots of things and you say, well, if I edited out everything that's crucial, there would be almost nothing here. And so I think that I avoided it entirely for a long time, which wasn't necessarily the best reaction. It's just that I felt if it was just going to be perfunctory, then it was disingenuous for me to just kind of slot that in. But then there are certain stories, I think, where I started to almost at random just pick places I knew very little about, but that just were specific. Because at the time it would seem, well, I could say Cleveland, which is a city in Ohio, which is a state in America, or I could sort of do a Calvino thing and like make up a place name. And I had done a little bit of that too. And I found that with the made up place names, there was a kind of like flag waving around that a little bit, like an announcement of inventiveness.
Right.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And it was drawing attention to the fantastical side of the story. And, you know, you talked about shame earlier. I didn't sort of even really get to address that. But I think when I was really first writing and first getting reviewed, AKA, you know, sort of scolded, there was a lot of, I think that what I internalized a lot was this sort of profound dissatisfaction with an excess of the fantastical, like sort of the there's too much that was invented. And so if too much is invented, how could we realistically feel much from the work? And I had this sense that I had to kind of put a corset around what was being invented. And also there was maybe a more aggressive conversation about what used to be called realism, that there were the realists who wrote about the here and now, the kind of actual world we live in. And then there were the fabulists who were really just doing kind of finger exercises and just little brainy things that had nothing to do with what it's like to be alive. And I certainly didn't see it that way. And I could still half cry reading a Borges story because I find some of that really stirring. But I think that I was looking for ways to kind of make what was invented feel not invented, feel a little more uncanny and uneasy and kind of a little closer to us. And so making up a place name and giving it some kind of interstellar character felt like sort of anathema to that. Mm-hmm. And then St. Louis was just random. And then I had to go to St. Louis after I wrote that story and answer to this portrait of that city. And then actually in the Grow Light, there's a story maybe from my last book called What Have You Done? It was set in Cleveland and it was published in a magazine. And there's a little picture of downtown Cleveland and I describe a building as this kind of almost like a long black hook and it's chrome and glass. And I kind of use a little bit of sort of familiar architectural language, but one of the characters is sort of impressed that it isn't just one of these generic skyscrapers that goes up. And then the fact checker for that magazine was really troubled that I'd used the real name of Cleveland, but that wasn't a real building in Cleveland.
So you had to build a real building in Cleveland.
Exactly.
Just to justify that.
Yeah, and I'm really behind on that.
I'm so sorry.
yeah. So I think, though, a lot of it is wrestling with, like, just the texture of the story and looking for things that feel almost like plain and anchoring so that the strangeness can have the feeling I want it to have. Mm. And maybe it is connected to earlier a feeling that I was too freely inventing without enough concern for some sort of a deeper emotional portrait. And so that's why these random cities come up. And there's a story I set in Dusseldorf where I've never been, but it just felt like it was perfectly adequate. And there too, there's a character who's often visiting a train station waiting for someone who's definitely not ever coming. And then I had to go through a lot of fact checking about my descriptions of that train station because I had no interest in the real train station of Dusseldorf, none. But it turns out that seems to be like a kind of a red flag for editors. If you are gonna use a real place, don't make up buildings in that place. That's my advice for my children now. because I have to tell them something, like something that'll really prepare them as they go out into the world.
You're
I'm a good parent.
I don't know why I laughed at that. I'm sure you are.
You don't know.
That's true. Are they in that bag? I wondered as well.
You're really concerned with my dad.
I am. Ellie. I've got one of my strange eyes over there, one over there. It's very distracting people in the front row with my strange expression. I wondered in terms of being fabulist and being realist. There's one character in George and Elizabeth, who is not George, who is blamed at one point correctly for decimating the Great Barrier Reef. I wondered how much recent concerns and fears, and justified fears, about the effect that technology is having on, and consumerism is having on, the environment and climate change. There was an article, I think, out today, or certainly this week, saying that every novel should address climate change unless it's going to be in the fantasy genre, because it should be so central.
It's always nice when we're told what to do as writers, because we have no idea.
No, it's...
When someone publishes the instruction, it's such a relief.
It's great. I can finally get my train from Dusseldorf and know that it's going to be going from 10 past 12 on platform 3. But I wondered whether you... There is a lot of kind of eco-turmoil in your work. Do you feel bound to research that? Or does that feel like it's too far stapling yourself into this kind of binary of, okay, this is realist and this is dystopian conjecture?
I try to research all the time, but I'm batting zero. I don't know if that works. That's a baseball expression. At actually kind of incorporating research into what I write. You know, in my novel, The Flame Alphabet, I did read a lot of Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah kind of after I'd written a draft of it, because I wanted to be able to sort of justify the way I had tried to reinvent Judaism in that book. Because Judaism at the time seemed like the most pliant religion and sort of the least doctrinaire to me, and I happen to be Jewish, but in a kind of casual or more ignorant way, sort of legacy. And so I read a lot of nonfiction all the time, and I had read The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert, which is a really cheery read about what's happening now, and there is a section on the Great Barrier Reef, and I just hadn't read anything that explicit about what was going on with that. Although the damage she depicts is not, it's not explicitly human caused, other than sort of the larger cause of global warming. It's not like a specific company out there mining so much as just a function of warming. So, you know, I think what I noticed that I've done after I've done it is that I'm interested in fiction in which things go wrong. That to me, the fiction I like generally involves people who want something who then most likely won't get it or will sort of imperil themselves in the pursuit of it. So that fiction is tracking the thwarting of a desire or the kind of lurching towards some sort of disappointment when that desire is met. And then that gets enacted in all kinds of ways. And so we don't lack examples for kind of calamity and peril. And so these things, I think, just are naturally appearing in my stories, not exactly in a calculated way. And you know, when I think of that detail with the character you're talking about, it seems, you know, it's like one of a long list of details about her, but you know, it's a brother sister story, but the brother doesn't really know his sister. I think there's a line about how she's sort of opted out of the world because of her wealth and fame, and she's, you know, he says something like, he refers to the city of New York on the phone to her, and she chuckles and says something like, it's funny that you still call it that. And like things like that come up because I think I'm hinting at like a class of people for whom now there's going to be sort of a new language for our world based on their understanding. It's not in the future where it's no longer called New York. This is someone in the present who's obscenely wealthy and in some kind of social situation that he can't even imagine. And so I think all of those things are hopefully functioning to make him feel more estranged from the world he thinks he's in.
That's glorious. Maybe that's glorious. At that point, maybe if we turn from the glorious lurchings and opting in of characters, does anyone in the audience want to ask a question of Ben or about any of his stories that we've maybe been mentioning?
You talked about research within your work. I just wondered at what point you kind of sit down and say, okay, there might be this specific place within the idea that's germinating or whatever. Where do you draw that line where I'm going to stop researching now and I'm going to let my imagination run free? Where does that come for you in the process?
I think I draw the line on the first day, in that often I'm trying to read a lot about what's called big data, because I kind of never understand what's meant by that. And so I'm reading some books about it. And I think what I'm really doing is just looking for something small that I can productively misunderstand, right? It's like something suggestive that isn't, I'm never going to be the kind of writer who's going to write, let's say, a definitively sort of historical work of fiction that's going to effortlessly sort of, you know, scaffold out how actual things work. I think when I was sort of first reading, I don't know, as a teenager, I noticed that I would read a little bit and I had a bad attention span and I would stop reading, but there were no devices then. There was really nothing. One lived out on a veld in a bed. There were no houses. And you just sort of read a little. And I would close the book and kind of keep reading in my head. Like I would sort of, it would continue to spin along as it might really for anyone. And I think it took me a long time to realize that I was sort of, that was actually writing, even though it was triggered by something I was reading. When I closed the book and kept doing it, I was sort of continuing something. And there was some wish fulfillment there. I was trying to make it into what I wanted. And so I read a lot of nonfiction. I really love, there's a series that Oxford does called The Very Short Introduction. They're sort of little lay people books that are not for specialists. And they're, you know, there's one on chemistry. There's one on A Very Short Introduction to Blood, which is sad that title is now taken. Because then I just think I would have really, really enjoyed using that title. But I'm reading about big data. I'm reading about economics, and I think I'm just looking for something, or possibly I'm procrastinating because I'm not ready or not capable of writing what I want to write. And so it's sort of hard to say, because I just really haven't written a book where I've really needed to do it. I want to do it because I want to fortify what I'm writing with just something that's more interesting than anything I can come up with. But I think I do it a little perversely and irresponsibly, because the stakes are a lot lower. I think, you know, no one's looking to me to sort of learn what the 70s were really like in New York City. You know, if I wrote a 70s novel in New York City, I would probably, all I could do would be to try to entertainingly get it wrong. And that would have limited value. So I'm trying to research all the time, but I'm never really effectively pouring it into what I'm working on. But maybe that will change. I'm working on a novel now and it needs help. It needs like a lifeline. And I need to figure out where to steal from so that it can come to life. So possibly my moment is coming.
You made a comment about the artificiality of fiction and your kind of struggles with that. But then you also had a really interesting discussion about how you sort of rejected realism in relation to fabulism. When you're putting words on the page, how do you physically put those words on the page when you're kind of struggling with?
You mean what do I look like when I'm doing it?
Yeah, pretty much.
You want to see like a demo?
Maybe can you like go through the brain thoughts?
I guess I always just was offended by that distinction around realism, and I saw realism itself as a term being seized upon by a certain group of writers, the writers sort of saying that if there are elements of fabulism in it, then it couldn't be real. And I think about it now in terms of emotional realism, and because I think we know that if we can connect to something emotionally, I know that just has more weight than whether or not it's sort of faithfully depicting like what people's clothes were like in a certain year in a certain city. So right, there seem to be different shades of it, and I think that if I'm detecting fraudulence or falsity or sort of hollowness, I just have trouble writing. To me, if I'm not writing, it's really just a sign that I don't care, because I don't feel like anyone especially needs me to keep writing. There's so many writers. It's not an industry where we're like, you know, we need more prose this month. We're going to run out. And so I'm really aware of that. I just, you know, and I've written some and it hasn't changed anything really for anyone. And so I don't sort of feel like I have to just be this sort of machine generating this stuff. I really do have to care. And now I have just ways of tricking myself into caring, like sort of believing I'll die if I won't do this, or someone else will die, someone close to me. It's like, we have your son, and unless you turn this prose in, you know, we're going to cut his head off. And I'm very disturbed, and I, you know, write the story.
That was very specific, that example you just gave.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to, and I signed an NDA, I'm not allowed
right,
to.
Yeah. Right. It's actually an anagram in all of your short stories, like, help
but, you know,
me.
But the feeling of realism is in a lot of ways really important to me. And yet, at the same time, I think I do a lot to kind of counteract that attempt to just represent what it's like to kind of go through the world. You know, I had a story, I think, in my previous book called Rollingwood, and it's about a separated couple who are taking turns taking care of their son. It's very, very little is really happening in the story, but at one point the main character and his son are sort of sitting on a hill, and a kind of inexplicable aircraft goes by overhead. It's just a little momentary thing, and the editor who was working with that story was just like, yeah, you know, why would you do that? And I think I did it because that plainness felt vulnerable, and I just wasn't feeling there was enough there. And it's almost like, why put creepy music in a movie when something sort of normal is happening? It's a tool to kind of adjust the mood, right? And so I am always, I think, looking to figure out how to really, really control the mood. In other words, how to kind of more specifically alter the chemical experience one is having while reading. You know, and I know when I read, if I'm reading something really amazing, I feel kind of chemically changed by it, really as if sort of drugged in a way that I don't find in the obvious recreational drugs out there. I haven't, you know, tried every single one. So I don't know. I mean, I'm straying a little from your question, but I care about it feeling really compelling, you know, and I think I'm also aware that everyone has better things to do than read, and that, you know, there are things competing for our attention. So I'm trying to sort of crack that.
Sorry if it's supremely boring to keep talking to you about realism, but I was wondering if perhaps you could think about some of your ambivalence about it, to do with the kind of relationship that kind of realism, if I'm thinking about kind of like, you know, 19th century realism, maybe the relationship that creates between the writer and the narrator and yeah, or the reader, or the, you know, the whatever, the protagonist and the reader. Because I think actually, you know, I was reading a book recently in which it describes this area of Bloomsbury very exactly,
yeah,
very precisely, in a way that I recognized, and it was like, oh hey, I know that road, I've been along that road, and it was very pleasing, and it sort of assures you, right, that your author has done their research, your author knows what they're talking about, perhaps either your author has been there or looked at a map or whatever, right?
Yeah, Bill's where authority it,
yeah. So then perhaps, you know, in the way that you're describing, you're kind of trying to circumvent that kind of complete trust in your in the your position as the writer or of the narrator in that kind of way, right? It like changes the relationship because you're no longer.
Well, not to be querulous, I would say I'm not, but I'm trying to find that connection you talk about in a little bit of a different way, and maybe more in terms of the psychological portrait, or just the sort of the interior look at the character. And I wasn't really meaning to disparage, you know, the writer who does the perfect description of a place, but rather to say, I can't do it. I don't know how. I don't have those skills. And I love really reading a whole range of stuff, and it's really important to me to not just read in the sort of category of what I want to do, because I want it. I always, you know, don't like myself well enough to insist on that, and I'm hoping by reading outside of my own traditions as much as I can, I'm going to impact what I do. So, you know, I want that. I'm not that interested in sort of ironizing the sort of authorial approach to writing and drawing attention to the fabrication or really metafiction at all at the moment. And so, but I, you know, I'm hoping people can find connections in, yeah, the depiction of states of mind. I don't know, the first story in the book is called Cold Little Bird, and it's about a couple raising a 9-year-old boy who announces he doesn't love them anymore. And everything else is sort of normal, and he's just like, I don't really want you to touch me, and I'll live in this house, but I just don't love you. And so he's sort of being chillingly adult. And like, what was important, the realism then that was important was the sort of the emotional aftermath of all of that. Not where is this happening and what does the apartment look like that they're in, right? So like I did still have that burden of some faithful reproduction, even though maybe none of us have even ever had that experience, but there was a burden to, on the one end, to me, not make this kid seem so monstrous that you could be dismissive of him and think, well, that's so invented that that would never happen and therefore I don't quite care. And then also to manage the way the parents dealt with such a problem without making them either, I don't know. So in other words, I felt as if I had created a problem in which I had to be as realistic as possible, but it might not have been in a way that we were talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of interested in the process of canon formation and how new generations of readers centralize what were formerly, for their parents' generation, maybe peripheral figures, and peripherize, not a word, but you understand what I mean, formerly central figures in a literary tradition of their country or whatever. And in relation to that, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about this anthology that you edited for Granta.
Right here.
Because I felt with that selection of stories, what you were talking about a second ago, feeling chemically changed by.
Yeah.
I felt the more or less the entirety of the selection had that impact on me, which was quite rare for, especially a selection of living writers, I feel. It didn't feel like a disparate grouping of, I mean, maybe they are your friends or whatever, but it didn't seem kind of a circumstantial collection that maybe there was more of a statement of purpose going on here or something different. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the sense of responsibility you felt in curating that kind of selection, you see what I mean?
Sure. Well, I had edited a short story anthology maybe 10 or 15 years earlier called The Anchor Book of New American Short Stories, and I had edited a little bit at magazines and just was always really reading a lot of short stories, and I've always been fascinated by the form, really obsessed by it, and I also believe as a form it can be as complex and intense and, I don't know, gratifying as a novel. There's bad novels, there's bad stories. So I also was teaching sort of from a fairly young age, sort of teaching when I was 9. That'd be really great, actually. And so when I was teaching, I was looking at younger writers and seeing what they were struggling with, what they were even interested in, and I was always, as one does, making copies of things and bringing them in and making what we call course packs. And I just thought, well, I don't know, maybe I could just put a book of these together. And after I did it, it seemed like the primary impact to me was that I just angered the people who weren't in it. And I just got a lot of angry letters. It's like, I thought you liked me, and why am I not in your book? And I really didn't want to do it again, because it just seemed, like, to me, it was sort of personal, and just, my criteria was I was just going to read stories over and over again, and if I kind of found a way to lose interest in them, they weren't going to go in. And I didn't want my opinion to have any particular weight, but I'm not a scholar, so I couldn't really sort of make an argument for significance outside of just the impact these stories had had on me. So anyway, I forgot the anger that I had caused, and I did it again, and I caused that anger again. And yeah, I think like 1 out of 9 people are mad at me.
Globally.
Yeah, right. And I don't know what the acceptable, I don't, you know, look at the poll every day, but I don't know what the acceptable number is. But yeah, it's a hard thing to say, because I don't really, at the one hand, want to, I have no real interest in saying definitively that these are the important stories, but rather that these are ones that I kind of can't get to the bottom of, that sort of hold their mystery in really interesting ways for me. Without being impenetrable, without being standoffish, they beguile me and they kind of vex me. And and I think I say in that introduction that I'm really not the person to kind of situate these really historically, or to even discuss them explicitly in terms of what some are doing and what some aren't. And I'm teaching this semester a course that is just on the very contemporary kind of this year American short story. We're gonna like look at things as they come out, and I'm, you know, essentially putting together a little bit of a living anthology again. So I don't know, I'd like to not have my editorial voice, you know, have that pressure on it to kind of be definitive, but maybe I'm not fully allowed that. When I was first growing up and reading, the anthologies were isolated into camps. There was one called The Vintage Book of New American Short Stories, edited by Tobias Wolff, really amazing writer, but who in his intro more or less says, these are stories of the heart. They are stories that will make you feel. You won't find that in the so-called postmodern, that was still when that word was used. You won't find that in postmodern stories, which are all about trickery and games, and they're drawing our attention to intellectual issues. I wanted a set of down-to-earth stories that are about what it's like to be a person, you know, in the world. And he was sort of putting up this barrier, and then there would be like a kind of answering anthology to that, and it was called The Anti-Story. And it was sort of saying, we're all in opposition to that. And that battle is really kind of snoozy and awful in a way. And I think you see a lot of writers, well, I don't know, George Saunders would be a really interesting example of someone who had completely internalized a lot of the traditional methods for making narrative, and yet at the same time found a way to kind of wedge in more spectral, fabulist, otherworldly stuff, and not even a little bit forfeit any kind of emotional sort of impact. And so I feel like I see a lot more of that now, and that battle is kind of over, or sort of, I don't know if anyone really connecting to that. So, you know, for me, like, I just wish more people would make anthologies and we could just sort of kind of pass them around. And I like to sort of see what other people are reading and really feeling impacted by. And then, you know, you have every fall in America, there's a book that comes out called The Best American Short Stories. And it's sort of preposterous to call it that. But then it's also really, it's got one editor, and they're saying, you know, that these are the best. And there's something called the O. Henry. And I'm always interested in those. And there's always interesting stories, and then stories that are real head scratchers that, you know, you just can't imagine how a single person on the planet would ever call it the best of anything. But people say that about stories I've put in here as well. And, you know, now a few years later, I'll read some stories in there and think, I don't know why I ever liked it.
on that note, making the polls change from 2 out of 9 hating Ben Marcus, please join me in thanking the LRB and Ben Marcus for being here this evening. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.